All right, our first speaker is Jessica Ware from Rutgers University, and the title of her talk is Phylogeny, Homoplasy, and Divergence Estimates within Libellulidia and Saptra Oronata, an exploration of the usefulness of molecular and morphological characters.
Sorry, that is the longest title probably in all of the ESA talks. So the group that I worked on for my PhD thesis were the Libellulidia, which are the spike-tails, river cruisers, emeralds, and skimmers. And the reason why I was interested in working on this project is because Libellulidia, it's a superfamily, and it makes up a little more than half of all the species of dragonflies, 51%. And a lot of people have wondered why Libellulidia are so successful. And the second most specious group of dragonflies, the Gomphidae, share in common what is probably a convergent evolution towards exophytic oviposition. So both of these groups have reduced ovipositors, and they don't require plant material to oviposit their eggs. They just kind of tap their abdomen on the water, whereas all other dragonflies do endophytic oviposition, where they cut a little hole in plant tissue and put their eggs in. And some people have suggested that perhaps this led to an expanded larval niche space, because female dragonflies didn't require plant material, so they were able to use temporary and transient bodies of water. And this is a picture taken when I was in the Namib Desert, where you actually find dragonflies. And they thought that some people have suggested this may have led to a rapid diversification in this group. So the methods I used to try and tease apart what was happening in the Libellulidia were to use molecular and morphological data. So for the molecular data, I used nuclear mitochondrial ribosomal information, as well as a couple protein coding genes. I aligned the ribosomal data with reference to secondary structure. And for morphology, it was really fun, because I looked at wing vein morphology, but I also looked at body characters, and male dragonflies have accessory genitalia at the base of their abdomen, so I looked at those characters, as well as penile and larval characters. And I ran parsimony and Bayesian analysis, but what I'm going to be talking about today are the results of the Bayesian analysis. And to do the Bayesian analysis, I used a doublet model, which takes into consideration the interdependence of stem sites, because in the secondary structure of the ribosome, the stem sites are hydrogen bonded together. And previously, some people had thought there was anywhere between 1 and 13 families in this group. But what we found was that there was just these four taxonomic groups. The skimmers here were strongly supported, the Corduliini, the Macromyidae, and then this strange group of mostly Australian endemics formed their own monophyletic clade at the base of the tree. And we are naming them the Synthemisidae, which was previously a subfamily name. And in general, most of the subfamilies that were previously proposed, there were 11 subfamilies in the family Libellulidae, most of them were based on wing venation, and they were really not strongly supported. And it's kind of a cool story, because in general, most taxonomy for dragonflies was based on wing veins. And if you look at the Tetrathemistinae, that was a family that was previously thought to be monophyletic, and as you can see, it's not. And it was grouped together because in the forewing, they have this kind of quadrangular cell and a really reduced anal vein region in the hindwing. But Dijkstra and Vick wrote a paper a couple of years ago suggesting that perhaps these were convergences based on the flight behavior of this dragonfly. It kind of lives in rainforests. Its larvae are kind of unique. They're kind of semi-terrestrial aquatic larvae. So it's kind of an interesting group. The Diastatopodini were another subfamily that was previously thought to be monophyletic, but we don't recover it as being monophyletic. And as you could probably guess, they were grouped together by the coloration of their wings. Some of them do this strange kind of fluttering flight, and what we now think, and certainly people have suggested this before, is that these are more for display purposes. And this guy right here, the amber wing, some people think that it's a wasp mimic. The Tramiini, or the saddlebags, they are kind of thought to be a monophyletic group because they have this expanded anal vein region, kind of looks like a saddlebag, but it's also not found to be monophyletic. And some people have suggested that this increases surface area, which decreases energy expenditure during flight, and these are gliding flyers, so that might be why they all have this characteristic. So in general, what we found was that wing venation-based taxonomic groups were not supported. So we tried to figure out, you know, how good of a data set are some of the other data sets, because in general for dragonfly papers, most people say, well, wing veins don't really work, but there's this other data set. If you just looked at larvae, or if you just looked at penile characters, you'd find something. So I'm showing the rescale consistency index here, but we also looked at the retention index and also the proportion of changes across a tree. And consistently, we found that each data set performed pretty poorly. It was not a very good data set due to high homoplasy. And in general, it's not just wing venation that is prone to functional constraints. And in dragonfly, for example, the penile characters, what dragonfly males do is they use their penis to displace sperm. So they either try and pack it further inside the female or scrape out the previous male sperm. And they've evolved all these little doohickeys to try and do that. And not only is it hard to try and figure out whether this salmon steak-shaped thing here is homologous with this little spiny thing here, but also, you know, there's a lot of homoplasy here. So these are not necessarily a reflection of phylogenetic history, but more a reflection of convergence because of function. This is also true of larval characters, because in the past people often said, you know, larvae are the way to go, and it's true that there are a lot of useful characters that you can look at, but some of the characters, like the number of spines on the abdomen here, Rasmus Hofmaller in Holland has suggested that that dragonflies that live in lakes that have fish have larger spines and a larger number of spines, and some of these protuberances here may be related to burrowing. So again, not necessarily a reflection of phylogenetic history, but a reflection of function and convergence. So the tree that we used was based on morphology and molecular data, and we tried to do some dating analysis, again, to answer questions about the evolution of this character, of exophytic oviposition. And what we found was that the root of the Libellulordia was around 214 million years old. And you can kind of see these are the ovipositors, the kind of progression from having the spike tails here, the chordulogastrids that have a first and second gonopophysis that's really elongated, to these strange kind of Australian endemics that have a reduced number of a reduced second gonopophysis, to the full reduction of the ovipositor here that we see in the macromeids, corduliids, and libellulids. And all of this was happening during the Cretaceous. When we look at the diversification rates in Libellulordia, the dragonflies that had the most reduction in their ovipositor had the highest rates of diversification for either a high or a low extinction rate. And what we see is this is right around the time when neopatrachid frogs were diversifying and the rise of modern birds. And when you do exophytic oviposition, it allows you to spend a lot less time at the water source, and you're a lot less vulnerable to predators. And both of these groups impose a pretty strong predation threat on female dragonflies who are ovipositing. So, you know, it's hard to tell with dating analysis. You kind of could say any hypothesis you want, really, but this is one that we think probably may have led to the rise of this trait. So, in general, the conclusions that we find is we don't really have as many families as we thought in dragonflies. We just have these four taxonomic groups. And in general, wing venation that supported subfamilies was probably inaccurate, probably not a reflection of phylogenetic history. And unfortunately for dragonflies, you really want, you know, people to be doing morphology, and we're trying to argue that morphology is really important. But what we found from our work is that a lot of the morphological data that we get from dragonflies is really not very good at providing resolution in the tree, and is very high in homoplasy. Again, the date that we got for the root of the tree for Libellulordia was 214 million years old, and diversification is highest in those that lack endophytic oviposition behavior. So I'd like to thank my advisors and collaborators. And it takes a lot of work to get specimens together. So thank you to everybody who provided specimens and funding sources. Thank you.
Time for a few questions.
Is there a level at which you think morphology would be useful in determining groups?
Well, I mean, there's certainly characters that you can use to distinguish families that's useful. But, I mean, definitely, one of the problems that we have in dragonfly systematics, and certainly reviewers comment on almost every single paper that I submit, that there's a lot of polytomies and not a lot of resolution, because you had rapid diversification in a short amount of time and really short internal nodes. And I don't think morphology is really going to help us answer that problem. Especially when it's trying to tease apart generic relationships and certainly species relationships within the Libellulidae, which is a group that a lot of people are interested in. What I think would be ideal would be if we could try and figure out a way. I know Frank Carl has suggested ways of having neapomorphies and coding your characters in a certain way and throwing out a batch that you think is a co-apomorphy or something that is convergently related. But I think it's kind of tricky when you're doing that to figure out ahead of time which characters you want to pick out of your data set and which ones you want to choose. It sounds a lot like you're manipulating your data set. But hopefully there's some way that we can kind of classify our morphological characters in such a way that they'll be useful. I don't want to be one of those people that says molecules are the way to go and morphology is bad, but we just seem to see so much homoplasy. It's not only does it not provide resolution to your tree, but also, as you can see, the taxonomy really is kind of has gotten misled, perhaps, over the years.
Oh, yeah.
What, pardon me?
The sperm competition characters, are they plesiomorphic in this group?
Well, it's almost every single species has their own version of kind of digger or pusher on their penis. And there was somebody in 1922 that tried to determine the homologous characters in the penis, and it's almost impossible to do so without having fresh specimens. So I don't really think people even know what the plesiomorphic penis, what the ground plan penis structure would look like. And I tried to do it with some dried specimens. It's pretty hard to do. And I think most people don't use penile characters in general for dragonfly morphology for that reason, just because it's so hard to... There's an inflatable sac, and so when it's inflated, then there's a sperm pump and it pushes the sperm out. But once you get a dried specimen, even a couple of hours after it's died, it shrivels into this weird kind of structure that doesn't look anything like what it looked like in life. And it also covers a bunch of other structures that when you try and lift it up, it breaks off and flies across the room and you have no idea what you had. So I think that's an area that needs more study, definitely.